It was so good to be there and know that Mama was alive and close by. Even the scrubbing made a safe, pleasant sound. Swish, a swish, a swish, a swish, a went the brush. Slup, a slup, a slup, slup, went the rag wiping up. Clunk, flump, went the brush and rag as Mama dropped them into the pail. Scrunk, scrunk, went the pail as Mama pushed it to the next area. Haven't you any girlfriends to talk to, Francie? No, I hate women. That's not natural. It would do you good to talk things over with girls your own age. Have you any women friends, Mama? No. I hate women, said Katie. See? You just like me. But I had a girlfriend once, and I got your father through her. So you see, a girlfriend comes in handy sometimes. She spoke jokingly, but her scrub brush seemed to swish out. You go your way, I'll go my way. She fought back her tears. Yes, she continued. You need friends. You never talk to anybody but Neely and me, and read your books and write your stories. I've given up writing. Kitty knew then that whatever was on Francie's mind had to do with her compositions. Did you get a bad mark on a composition today? No, lied Francie, amazed as always by her mother's guesswork. She got up. I guess it's time for me to go to McGarrity's now. Wait! Katie put her brush and scrub rag in the pail. I'm finished for the day, she held out her hands. Help me to get up. Francie grasped her mother's hands. Katie pulled heavily on them as she got to her feet clumsily. Walk back home with me, Francie. Francie carried the pail. Katie put one hand on the banister and put her other arm around Francie's shoulder. She leaned heavily on the girl as she walked downstairs slowly, Francie keeping time with her mother's uncertain steps. Francie, I expect the baby any day now, and I'd feel better if you were never very far away from me. Stay close to me. And when I'm working, come looking for me from time to time to see that I'm all right. I can't tell you how much I'm counting on you. I can't count on Neely because a boy's no use at a time like this. I need you badly now, and I feel safer when I know you're nearby. So stay close to me for a while. A great tenderness for her mother came into Francie's heart. I won't ever go away from you, Mama, she said. That's my good girl. Katie pressed her shoulder. Maybe, thought Francie, she doesn't love me as much as she loves Neely, but she needs me more than she needs him, and I guess being needed is almost as good as being loved. Maybe better. Two days, Francie came home for lunch and did not return to school in the afternoon. Mama was in bed. After Neely was told to go back to school, Francie wanted to get Sissy or Evie, but Mama said it wasn't time yet. Francie felt important being in sole charge. She cleaned the flat and looked over the food in the house and planned their supper. Every 10 minutes, she plumped up her mother's pillow and asked whether she wanted a drink of water. Soon after 3, Neely rushed in out of breath, flung his books in a corner, and asked whether it was time to run for anybody yet. Katie smiled at his eagerness and said it was no use taking Evie or Sissy away from their own affairs until it was necessary. Neely went off to work with instructions to ask McGarrity if he could do Francie's work as well as his own, since Francie had to stay home with their mother. McGarrity not only agreed, but helped the boy with the free lunch so that Neely was all finished at 4:30. They had supper early. The sooner Neely started with his papers, the quicker he'd be finished. Mama said she didn't want anything except a cup of hot tea. Mama didn't want the tea after Francie brewed it. Francie worried because she wouldn't eat anything. After Neely left on his paper route, Francie brought in a bowl of stew and tried to make her mother eat it. Katie lashed out at her, told her to leave her alone. That when she wanted something to eat, she'd ask for it. Francie poured it back into the pot, trying to hold back the hurt tears. She had only meant to help. Mama called her again and didn't seem mad anymore. What time is it? Asked Katie. 5 to 6. Are you sure the clock isn't slow? No, Mama. Maybe it's fast, then. She seemed so worried that Francie looked out the front window at Jeweler Waranoff's large street clock. Our clock's right, reported Francie. Is it dark out yet? Katie had no way of knowing, because even at bright noon only a dull gray light filtered through the air shaft window. No, it's still light outdoors. It's dark in here, said Katie fretfully. I'll light the night candle. Bracketed to the wall was a small shelf holding a plaster statue of the blue-robed Virgin Mary with her hands held out supplicatingly. At the foot of the image was a thick red glass filled with yellow wax and a wick. Next to it was a vase holding paper red roses. Francie put a lighted match to the wick. The candlelight glowed dully and ruby red through the thick glass. "What time is it?" Katie asked after a little while. 10 after 6. "You sure the clock is neither slow nor fast?" "Just exactly right." Katie seemed satisfied, but 5 minutes later she again demanded the time. It was as if she had an important rendezvous to keep and was fearful of being late. At 6:30, Francie told her the time again and added that Neely would be home in an hour. "The minute he comes in, send him for Aunt Evie. Tell him not to take the time to walk. Find a nickel carfare for him and tell him Evie, because she lives closer than Sissy." "Mama, suppose the baby comes all of a sudden and I don't know what to do?" "I couldn't be that lucky, to have a baby all of a sudden. What time is it?" 6:55. "Sure?" "I'm sure. Mama, even if Neely is a boy, it would have been better if he stayed with you instead of me." "Why?" "Because he's always such a great comfort to you." She said it without malice or jealousy. It was a simple statement of fact. "Well, I just don't know the right things to say to make you feel better." "What time is it?" 6:55. Katie was silent for a long time. When she spoke, she said the words quietly, as if speaking to herself. No, men shouldn't be around at that time. Yet women make them stand next to them. They want them to hear every moan and groan and see every drop of blood and hear every tear of the flesh. What is this twisted pleasure they get out of making the man suffer along with them? They seem to be taking revenge because God made them women. "What time is it?" Without waiting for an answer, she continued. "Before they married, they'd die if a man saw them in curl crimpers or with their corsets off. But when they have a baby, they want him to see them in the ugliest way a woman can be seen. I don't know why. I don't know why. A man thinks of the pain and agony that came to her out of their being together, and then it isn't good any more to him. That's why many men start being unfaithful after the baby." Katie hardly realized what she was saying. She was missing Johnny so terribly and thinking so, to rationalize his not being there. Besides, there is this. If you love someone, you'd rather suffer the pain alone to spare them, so keep your man out of the house when your time comes. "Yes, Mama. It's 6:55. See if Neely's coming." Francie looked and had to report that Neely wasn't in sight yet. Katie's mind went back to what Francie had said about Neely being a comfort. "No, Francie, it's you who's the comfort to me now." She sighed. "If it's a boy, we'll call him Johnny. It will be nice, Mama, when there are 4 of us again." "Yes, it will." After that, Katie didn't say anything for a while. When next she asked the time, Francie told her it was 7:15 and that Neely would be home soon. Katie instructed her to wrap Neely's nightshirt, toothbrush, a clean towel, and a bit of soap in a newspaper, as Neely was to remain at Effie's house for the night. Francie made 2 more trips to the street with a bundle under her arm before she saw Neely coming. He was running down the street. She ran to meet him, gave him the bundle, carfare, and instructions, and told him to hurry. "How's Mama?" he asked. "Good. You sure?" "Sure. I hear a trolley coming. You better run." Neely ran. When Francie got back, she saw that her mother's face was bathed in sweat and that there was blood on her lower lip as though she had bitten through it. "Oh, Mama! Mama!" She shook her mother's hand and held it to her own cheek. "Wring a cloth out of cold water and wipe my face," Mama whispered. After Francie had done so, Katie went back to what was incompleted in her mind. "Of course you're a comfort to me." Her mind veered off to something that seemed irrelevant but wasn't. "I've always been meaning to read your A compositions, but I never had the time. I've a little time now. Would you like to read one to me?" "I can't. I burned them all up." "You thought about them and wrote them and handed them in and got marks on them and thought about them some more, and then you burned them up. And all through that, I never read one of them." "That's all right, Mama. They weren't much good." "It's on my conscience. They weren't much good, Mama. And I know you never had the time," Katie thought. "But I always had time for anything the boy did. I made time for him." She continued her thought aloud. "But then Neely needs more encouragement. You can go on with what you have inside you, like I can, but he needs so much from outside." "That's all right, Mama," Francie repeated. "I couldn't do any different than I did," said Katie. "But it will always be on my conscience just the same. What time is it?
Nearly 7:30.
The towel again, Francie.
Katie's mind seemed to be trying to clutch at something.
And isn't there one left you can read?
Francie thought of the four about her father, what Miss Garnder had said about them, and answered, No.
Then read something from the Shakespeare book.
Francie got the book.
Read about, 'Twas on a night like this. I'd like to have something pretty in my mind, just before the baby comes.
The print was so small that Francie had to light the gas to read. As the light flared up, she had a good look at her mother's face. It was gray and contorted. Mama didn't look like Mama. She looked like Grandma Mary Romilly in pain. Katie winced away from the light, and Francie shut it off quickly.
Mama, we've read these plays so many times over that I almost know them by heart. I don't need a light or the book. Mama, listen,
she recited.
The moon shines bright in such a night as this, when the sweet wind did gently kiss the trees, and they did make no noise in such a night. Troilus,
what time is it?
7:40. Methinks mounted the Trojan walls, and sighed his soul towards the Grecian tents, where Cressida lay the night. And did you ever find out who Troilus was, Francie? And Cressida?
Yes, Mama.
Some day you must tell me, when I have time to listen.
I will, Mama.
Katie moaned. Francie wiped the sweat away again. Katie held out her two hands, as she had done that day in the hall. Francie took the hands and braced her feet. Katie pulled, and Francie thought her arms would come out of their sockets. Then Mama relaxed and let go. So the next hour passed. Francie recited passages she knew by heart. Portia's speech, Mark Antony's funeral oration, Tomorrow and Tomorrow. The obvious things that are remembered from Shakespeare. Sometimes Katie asked a question, sometimes she put her hands over her face and moaned. Without knowing, she did so, and taking no note of the answer, she kept asking the time. Francie wiped off her face at intervals, and three or four times in that hour, Katie held out her two hands to Francie. When Evie arrived at 8:30, Francie all but died of pure relief.
"Aunt Sissy will be along in 30 minutes, announced Evie as she rushed into the bedroom.
After a look at Katie, Evie pulled the sheet from Francie's cot, knotted one end to Katie's bedpost, and put the other end in Katie's hand. "Try pulling on that for a change," she suggested.
"What time is it?"
whispered Katie after she had taken a tremendous tug on the sheet, a tug that made the sweat stand out on her face again.
"What do you care?" answered Evie cheerfully. "You're not going any place."
Katie started a smile, but a pain spasm wiped it off her face.
"We can do with a better light," decided Evie.
"But the gaslight hurts her eyes," objected Francie.
Evie took the glass globe from the parlor fixture, coated the outside with soap, and attached it to the bedroom fixture. When she lit the gas, there was a soft, diffused light, without glare. Although it was a warm May night, Evie built a fire in the range. She snapped out orders to Francie. Francie rushed around filling the kettle with water and placing it over the flames. She scoured the enameled wash basin and poured a bottle of sweet oil in it and set it on the back of the stove. The soiled clothes were dumped out of the wash basket, and it was lined with a ragged but clean blanket and set up on two chairs near the stove. Evie put all the dinner plates in the oven to heat and instructed Francie to put hot plates into the basket, remove them when they cooled, and substitute other hot plates.
"Has your mother any baby clothes?" she asked.
"What kind of people do you think we are?"
asked Francie scornfully, as she displayed a modest layette consisting of 4 handmade flannel kimonos, 4 bands, 12 hand-hemmed diapers, and 4 threadbare shirts which she and Neely had worn in turn as babies.
"And I made everything myself, excepting the shirts," admitted Francie proudly.
"Hmm, I see your mother's looking for a boy," commented Evie, examining the blue feather stitching on the kimonos.
"Well, we shall see."
When Sissy arrived, the two sisters went into the bedroom, ordering Francie to wait outside. Francie listened to them talking.
"It's time to get the midwife," Sissy said. "Does Francie know where she lives?"
"I didn't make arrangements," Katie said. "There just isn't $5 in the house for a midwife."
"Well, maybe Sissy and I can raise the money," began Evie, "if..."
"Look," Sissy said. "I bore 11 children. You had 3, and Katie had 2. Among us, we had 16 children. We ought to know enough to bring a baby."
"All right. We'll bring the baby," decided Evie.
Then they closed the bedroom door. Now Francie could hear the sound of their voices, but couldn't hear what they said. She resented her aunt's shutting her out like that, especially when she had been in complete charge until they came. She took the cool plates from the basket, put them into the oven, and took out two heated plates. She felt all alone in the world. She wished that Neely was home, so that they could talk about olden times. Francie opened her eyes with a start. She couldn't have been drowsing, she thought. She just couldn't have. She felt the plates in the basket. They were cold. Quickly, she substituted hot plates. The basket had to be kept warm for the baby. She listened to the sounds from the bedroom. They had changed since she nodded. There was no more leisurely moving to and fro, no more quiet talking. Her aunt seemed to be running back and forth with quick, short steps, and their voices came in short sentences. She looked at the clock. 9:30. Evie came out of the bedroom, shutting the door behind her. "Here's 50 cents, Francie. Go out and get a quarter pound of sweet butter, a box of soda crackers, and 2 navel oranges. Tell the man you want navel. Say they're for a sick lady." "But all the stores are closed." "Go down to Jewtown. They're always open." "I'll go in the morning."
"Do as you're told," said Evie sharply.
Francie went unwillingly. Going down the last flight of stairs, she heard a hoarse, guttural scream. She stopped, undecided whether to run back or to continue. She remembered Evie's sharp command and continued down the stairs. As she reached the door, there was another and more agonized scream. She was glad to get out onto the street. In one of the flats, the ape-like teamster ordering his unwilling wife to prepare for bed heard Katie's first scream and ejaculated, "Jesus!" When the second scream came, he said, "I hope to Christ she don't keep me awake all night." His childlike bride wept as she unfastened her dress. Flossie Gaddis and her mother were sitting in their kitchen. Floss was sewing on another costume, one of white satin intended for her delayed marriage to Frank. Mrs. Gaddis was knitting on a gray sock for Henny. Henny was dead, of course, but all of his life the mother had knit socks for him, and she couldn't let go of the habit. Mrs. Gaddis dropped a stitch when the first scream came. Floss said, "The men have all the fun, and women the pain." The mother said nothing. She trembled when next Katie cried out. "It seems funny," said Floss, "to be making a costume with 2 sleeves.
"Yes."
They worked a while in silence before Floss spoke again.
"I wonder, are they worth it? The children, I mean."
Mrs. Gaddis thought of her dead son and her daughter's withered arm. She said nothing. She bent her head over her knitting. She had come around to the place where she dropped a stitch. She concentrated on picking it up. The spare Tinmore spinsters lay in their hard, virginal bed. They groped for each other's hands. "Did you hear it, sister?" asked Miss Maggie.
"A time has come," answered Miss Lizzie.
"That's why I didn't marry Harvey, long ago when he asked me. I was afraid of that. So afraid." "I don't know," Miss Lizzie said. "Sometimes I think it's better to suffer bitter unhappiness and to fight and to scream out and even to suffer that terrible pain than just to be safe." She waited until the next scream died away. "At least she knows she's living." Miss Maggie had no answer. The flat across the hall from the Nolans was vacant. The remaining flat in the house was occupied by a Polish Doc Walloper, his wife and their 4 kids. He was filling a glass from a can of beer on the table when he heard Katie.
"Women," he grunted contemptuously. "Shut up, you," snarled his wife.
And all the women in the house tensed each time Katie cried out, and they suffered with her. It was the only thing the women held in common, the sure knowledge of the pain of giving birth. Francie had to walk a long way up Manhattan Avenue before she found a Jewish dairy open. She had to go to another store for the crackers and then find a fruit stand that had navel oranges. As she came back, she glanced at the large clock in Knipe's drugstore and noted that it was nearly 10:30. She didn't care what time it was except that it seemed so important to her mother. When she walked into the kitchen, she felt a difference. There was a new quiet feeling and an indefinable smell, new and faintly fragrant. Sissy was standing with her back to the basket.
"What do you think?" she said.
"You have a baby sister."
"Mama?"
"Your mother's fine."
"So that's why I was sent to the store."
"We thought you knew too much already for 14," said Evie, coming out of the bedroom.
"I just want to know the one thing," said Francie fiercely. "Did Mama send me out?"
"Yes, Francie, she did," said Sissy gently. "She said something about sparing those you love."
All right, then, said Francie, mollified.
Don't you want to see the baby?
Sissy stepped aside. Francie lifted the blanket from the baby's head. The baby was a beautiful little thing, with white skin and downy black curls which grew down into a point on her forehead, like Mama's. The baby's eyes opened briefly. Francie noticed that they were a milky blue. Sissy explained that all new babies had blue eyes, and that probably they'd be dark as coffee beans as she grew older.
It looks like Mama, Francie decided.
That's what we thought, said Sissy.
Is it all right?
Perfect, Evie told her. Not crooked or anything?
Certainly not. Where do you get such ideas?
Francie didn't tell Evie how she was afraid the baby would be born crooked because Mama had worked on her hands and knees up to the last minute.
May I go in and see Mama?
She asked humbly, feeling like a stranger in her own home.
You can bring the plate into her.
Francie took the plate holding two buttered crackers into her mother.
Hello, Mama.
Hello, Francie. Mama looked like Mama again, only very tired. She couldn't raise her head, so Francie held the crackers while she ate them. After they were gone, Francie stood holding the empty plate. Mama said nothing. It seemed to Francie that she and Mama were strangers again. The closeness of the last few days was gone.
And you had a boy's name picked out, Mama.
Yes. But I don't mind a girl, really.
She's pretty.
She'll have black curling hair. And Neely has blonde curling hair. Poor Francie got the straight brown hair.
I like straight brown hair, Francie said defiantly. She was dying to know the baby's name, but Mama seemed like such a stranger now that she didn't like to ask outright.
Shall I write the information out to send to the Board of Health?
No, the priest will send it in when she's christened.
Oh. Katie recognized the disappointment in Francie's tone. But bring in the ink and the book, and I'll let you write down her name. Francie took the Gideon Bible that Sissy had swiped nearly 15 years ago from the mantelpiece. She looked at the four entries on the flyleaf. The first three were in Johnny's fine, careful hand. January 1st, 1901. Married. Catherine Romilly and John Nolan. December 15th, 1901. Born. Francis Nolan. December 23rd, 1902. Born. Cornelius Nolan. The fourth entry was in Katie's firm backhand slant. December 25th, 1915. Died. John Nolan. Age 34. Sissy and Evie followed Francie into the bedroom. They too were curious as to what Katie would name the baby. Sarah? Eva? Ruth? Elizabeth? Write this down, Katie dictated. May 28th, 1916. Born? Francie dipped her pen in the ink bottle. Annie Laurie Nolan.
Annie, such an ordinary name, groaned Sissy.
Why, Katie? Why? Demanded Evie patiently.
A song that Johnny sang once, explained Katie.
As Francie wrote the name, she heard the chords. She heard her father singing. And 'twas there that Annie Laurie.
Papa. Papa.
A song, he said, that belonged to a better world, Katie went on. He would have liked the child named after one of his songs.
Laurie is a pretty name, said Francie.
And Laurie became the baby's name. Laurie was a good baby. She slept contentedly most of the time. When she was awake, she put in the time lying quietly and trying to focus her berry brown eyes on her infinitesimal fist. Katie nursed the baby, not only because it was the instinctive thing to do, but because there was no money for fresh milk. Since the baby couldn't be left alone, Katie started her work at 5 in the morning, doing the other two houses first. She worked until nearly 9 when Francie and Neely left for school. Then she cleaned her own house, leaving the door of her flat ajar in case Laurie cried. Katie went to bed immediately after supper each night, and Francie saw so little of her mother that it seemed as if Mama had gone away. McGarity didn't fire them after the baby's birth as he had planned. He really needed them now, because his business boomed suddenly in that spring of 1916. His saloon was crowded all the time. Great changes were taking place in the country, and his customers, like Americans everywhere, had to get together to talk things over. The corner saloon was their only gathering place, the poor man's club. Francie, working in the flat above the saloon, heard their raised voices through the thin floorboards. Often she paused in her work and listened. Yes, the world was changing rapidly, and this time she knew it was the world and not herself. She heard the world changing as she listened to the voices. It's a fact. They're going to stop making liquor, and in a few years the country will be dry.
A man that works hard has a right to his beer.
Tell that to the president and see how far you get. This is a people's country. If we don't want it dry, it won't be dry. Sure, it's a people's country, but they're going to push prohibition down your throat. By Jesus, I'll make my own wine then. My old man used to make it in the old country. You take a bushel of grapes. Go on. They'll never give women the vote. Don't lay any bets on it.
If that comes, my wife votes like I do. Otherwise, I'll break her neck.
My old woman wouldn't go to the polls and mix in with a bunch of bums and rummies.
A woman president? That might be.
They'll never let a woman run the government.
There's one running it right now.
Like hell.
Wilson can't turn around and go to the bathroom unless he asks Mrs. Wilson if it's okay by her.
Wilson's an old woman himself.
He's keeping us out of war.
That college professor. What we need in the White House is a sound politician and not a schoolteacher.
Automobiles. Soon the horse will be a thing of the past.
That fella out in Detroit's making cars so cheap that soon every working man can have one.
A laborer driving his own car. You should live so long.
Airplanes. Just a crazy fad. Won't last long.
The moving pictures is here to stay. The theaters is closing up one by one in Brooklyn. Take me. I'd rather see this year Charlie Chaplin any day than this year Corset Peyton the wife goes for.
Wireless. Greatest thing ever invented. Words come through the air, mind you, without wires. You need a kind of machine to catch it and earphones to listen in. They call it twilight sleep, and a woman don't feel a thing when the kid comes. So when this friend tells my wife, she says that it's about time they invented something like that.
What are you talking about? Gaslight's out of date. They're putting electricity even in the cheapest tenements.
Don't know what's got into the youngsters nowadays. They're all dance crazy. Dance, dance, dance.
So I changed my name from Schultz to Scott. The judge says, what do you want to go and do that for? Schultz is a good name. He was German himself, see?
Listen, Mac, I says. That's just how I talk to him, judge or no judge. I'm through with the old country, I says. After what they done to them Belgian babies, I says, I want no part of Germany. I'm an American now, I says, and I want an American name.
And we're heading straight for war. Man, I can see it coming.
All we got to do is to elect Wilson again this fall. He'll keep us out of war.
Don't bet on them campaign promises. When you got a Democrat president, you got a war president.
Lincoln was a Republican.
But the South had a Democrat president, and they was the ones started the Civil War.
I ask you how long we gotta stand for it. The bastards sunk another one of our ships. How many do they gotta sink before we get up enough nerve to go over there and lick hell out of them?
We got to stay out. This country's getting along fine. Let them fight their own wars without dragging us in.
We don't want war.
War's declared. I'll enlist the next day.
You can talk. You're past 50. They wouldn't take you. I'd sooner go to jail than to war.
A feller's got to fight for what he thinks is right. I'd be glad to go. I got nothing to worry about. I got a double hernia. Let the war come. They'll need us working men then to build their ships and their guns. They'll need a farmer to grow their food. Then watch them come sucking around us. Us laborers will have the goddamn capitalists by the throat. They won't tell us. We'll tell them. By Jesus, we'll make them sweat. War can't come quick enough to suit me.
Like I'm telling you. Everything is machines. I heard a joke the other day. Fella and his wife going around getting food, clothes, everything out of machines. So they come to this baby machine, and the fella puts money in, and out comes a baby. So the fella turns around and says, give me the good old days.
The good old days. Yeah, I guess they're gone forever.
Fill 'em up again, Jim.
And Francie, pausing in her sweeping to listen, tried to put everything together and tried to understand a world spinning in confusion. And it seemed to her that the whole world changed in between the time that Laurie was born and graduation day. Francie hardly had time to get used to Lori when graduation night came around. Katie couldn't go to both graduations, so it was decided that she'd go to Neely's, and that was right. Neely shouldn't be deprived because Francie had felt like changing schools. Francie understood but felt a bit hurt just the same. Papa would have gone to see her graduate if he were living. They arranged that Sissy go with Francie. Evie would stay with Lori. On the last night in June, 1916, Francie walked for the last time to the school she so loved. Sissy, quiet and changed since she got her baby, walked sedately beside her. Two firemen passed, and Sissy never so much as noticed, and there had been a time when Sissy couldn't resist a uniform. Francie wished Sissy hadn't changed. It made her feel lonesome. Her hand crept into Sissy's, and Sissy squeezed it. Francie was comforted. Sissy was still Sissy underneath. The graduates sat in the front part of the auditorium and the guests in the back. The principal made an earnest speech to the children about how they were going out into a troubled world and about how it would be up to them to build a new world after the war which was sure to come to America. He urged them onto higher education so that they would be better equipped for this world-building. Francie was impressed and vowed in her heart that she'd help carry the torch, like he said. Then came the graduation play. Francie's eyes burned with unshed tears. As the diluted dialogue droned on, she thought, "My play would have been better. I would have taken the ash can out. I would have done whatever teacher said if she had only let me write the play." After the play, they marched up, got their diplomas, and were graduates at last. The oath of allegiance to the flag and the singing of the Star-Spangled Banner clinched it. And now came the time of Francie's Gethsemane. It was the custom to present bouquets to the girl graduates. Since flowers were not allowed in the auditorium, they were delivered to the classrooms, where the teachers placed them on the recipient's desk. Francie had to go back to her room to get her report card, also her pencil box and autograph book, from her desk. She stood outside, nerving herself for the ordeal, knowing her desk would be the only one without flowers. She was sure, because she hadn't told Mama about the custom, knowing there was no money at home for such things. Deciding to get it over with, she went in and walked straight to the teacher's desk, not daring to look at her own. The air was thick with flower scents. She heard the girls chattering and squealing with delight over their flowers. She heard the exchange of triumphant admiration. She got her report card, 4 A's and 1 C-. The latter was her English mark. She used to be the best writer in school, and here she ended up barely passing English. Suddenly she hated the school and all the teachers, especially Miss Garnder. And she didn't care about not getting flowers. She didn't care. It was a silly custom anyway. "I'll go to my desk and get my things," she decided, "and if anyone speaks to me, I'll tell them to shut up, and then I'll walk out of this school forever and not say goodbye to anyone." She raised her eyes. "The desk without flowers on it will be mine." But there were no empty desks. There were flowers on every single one. Francie went to her desk, reasoning that a girl had placed one of her bouquets there for a moment. Francie planned to pick it up and hand it to the owner, saying coolly, "Do you mind? I have to get something out of my desk." She picked up the flowers, 2 dozen dark red roses on a sheaf of ferns. She cradled them in her arm, the way the other girls did, and pretended for a moment that they were hers. She looked for the owner's name on the card. But her own name was on the card. Her name. The card said, "For Francie on graduation day. Love from Papa." Papa. The writing was in his fine, careful hand, in the black ink from the bottle in the cupboard at home. Then it was all a dream. A long, mixed-up dream. Lori was a dream, and the working at McGarity's, and the graduation play, and the bad mark in English. She was waking up now, and everything would be all right. Papa would be waiting out in the hall. But there was only Sissy in the hall. "Then Papa is dead," she said. "Yes," said Sissy. "And it's 6 months now." "But he can't be, Aunt Sissy. He sent me flowers." "Francie, about a year ago he gave me that card all written out, and $2. He said, 'When Francie graduates, send her some flowers for me, in case I forget.'" Francie started to cry. It wasn't only because she was sure now that nothing was a dream. It was because she was unstrung from working too hard and worrying about Mama, because she didn't get to write the graduation play, because she got a bad mark in English, because she had been too well prepared not to receive flowers. Sissy took her to the girls' washroom and pushed her into a booth. "Cry loud and hard," she ordered, "and hurry up. Your mother will be wondering what's keeping us." Francie stood in the booth, clutching her roses and sobbing. Each time the washroom door opened and chattering announced incoming girls, she flushed the toilet so that the noise of the water would drown out her sobs. Soon she was over it. When she came out, Sissy had a handkerchief wet with cold water to hand her. As Francie mopped her eyes, Sissy asked whether she felt better. Francie nodded yes and begged her to wait a moment while she said her goodbyes. She went into the principal's office and shook hands with him. "Don't forget the old school, Francis. Come back and see us sometime," he said. "I will," promised Francie. She went back to say goodbye to her classroom teacher. "We'll miss you, Francis," said teacher. Francie got her pencil box and autograph book from her desk. She started to say goodbye to the girls. They crowded around her. One put her arm around her waist, and two others kissed her cheek. They called out goodbye messages. "Come to my house to see me, Francis. Write to me, Francis, and let me know how you're getting along. Francis, we have a telephone now. Ring me up sometime. Ring me up tomorrow. Write something in my autograph book, huh, Francis? So's I can sell it when you get famous. I'm going to summer camp. I'll put down my address. Write to me. Hear, Francis? I'm going to Girls High in September. You come to Girls High too, Francis. No, come to Eastern District High with me. Girls High, Eastern District. Erasmus Hall High is the best. You come there, Francis, with me, and we'll be friends all through high school. I'll never have any other friend but you if you'll come. Francis, you never let me write in your autograph book. Me neither. Gimme, gimme. They wrote in Francie's all but empty book. They're nice, Francie thought. I could have been friends with them all the time. I thought they didn't want to be friends. It must have been me that was wrong. They wrote in the book. Some wrote small and cramped, others loose and sprawling, but all the writing was the handwriting of children. Francie read as they wrote. "I wish you luck, I wish you joy, I wish you first a baby boy, and when his hair begins to curl, I wish you then a baby girl." Florence Fitzgerald. "When you are married and your husband gets cross, sock him with the poker and get a divorce." Jeannie Lee. "When night draws back the curtain and pins it with a star, remember I am still your friend, though you may wander far." Noreen O'Leary. Beatrice Williams turned to the last page in the book and wrote, "Way back here and out of sight, I sign my name just for spite." She signed it, "Your fellow writer, Beatrice Williams." She would say fellow writer, thought Francie, still jealous about the play. Francie got away at last. Out in the hall, she said to Sissy, "Just one more goodbye." "It's taking you the longest time to graduate," protested Sissy good-naturedly. Miss Garnder sat at her desk in her brilliantly lighted room. She was alone. She wasn't popular, and so far no one had been in to say goodbye. She looked up eagerly as Francie entered. "So you've come to say goodbye to your old English teacher," she said, pleased. "Yes, ma'am." Miss Garnder couldn't let it go at that. She had to be a teacher. "About your mark. You haven't turned in work this term. I should have failed you, but at the last moment I decided to pass you so that you could graduate with your class." She waited. Francie said nothing. "Well, aren't you going to thank me?" "Thank you, Miss Garnder." "You remember our little chat?" "Yes, ma'am." "Why did you turn stubborn and stop handing in work then?" Francie had nothing to say. It was something she couldn't explain to Miss Garnder. She held out her hand. "Goodbye, Miss Garnder." Miss Garnder was taken aback. "Well, goodbye then," she said. They shook hands. "In time to come. You'll see I was right, Francis." Francie said nothing. "Won't you?" Miss Garnder asked sharply. "Yes, ma'am." Francie went out of the room. She did not hate Miss Garnder anymore. She didn't like her, but she felt sorry for her. Miss Garnder had nothing in all the world, excepting a sureness about how right she was. Mr. Jensen stood on the school steps. He took each child's hand in both of his and said, "Goodbye, and God bless you." He added a personal message for Francie. "Be good, work hard, and reflect credit on our school." Francie promised that she would. On the way home, Sissy said, "Look, let's not tell your mother who sent the flowers. Abel started to remembering, and she's just about getting well after Laurie. They agreed to say that Sissy bought the flowers. Francie removed the card and put it in her pencil box. When they told Mama the lie about the flowers, she said, "Sissy, you shouldn't have spent your money." But Francie could tell that Mama was pleased. The two diplomas were admired, and everyone agreed that Francie's was the prettiest on account of Mr. Jensen's fine handwriting. "The first diplomas in the Nolan family," said Katie. "But not the last, I hope," said Sissy. "I'm going to see to it that each of my children have three," said Evie. "Grade school, high school, and college." "In 25 years," said Sissy, "our family will have a stack of diplomas this high." She stood on tiptoe and measured 6 feet from the ground. Mama examined the report cards for the last time. Neely had B in conduct, the same in physical education, and C in all his other subjects. Mama said, "That's good, son." She looked past Francie's A's and concentrated on the C-. "Francie, I'm surprised. How did this happen?" "Mama, I don't want to talk about it." "And in English, too. Your best subject." Francie's voice notched up higher as she repeated, "Mama, I don't want to talk about it." "She always wrote the best compositions in school," explained Katie to her sisters. "Mama!" It was almost a scream. "Katie, stop it," ordered Sissy sharply. "All right, then," surrendered Katie, suddenly aware that she was nagging and ashamed of herself. Evie jumped in with a change of subject. "Do we have that party, or don't we?" she asked. "I'm putting my hat on," Katie said. Sissy stayed with Laurie while Evie, Mama, and the two graduates went to Shifley's ice cream saloon for the party. Shifley's was crowded with graduation parties. The kids had their diplomas with them, and the girls brought their bouquets. There was a mother or a father, sometimes both, at each table. The Nolan party found a free table at the back of the room. The place was a medley of shouting kids, beaming parents, and rushed waiters. Some kids were 13, a few 15, but most of them Francie's age, 14. Most of the boys were Neely's classmates, and he had a great time hollering greetings across the room. Francie hardly knew the girls, nevertheless she waved and called out to them as gaily as though they had been close friends for years. Francie was proud of Mama. The other mothers had graying hair, and most of them were so fat that their backsides slopped over the edges of the chair. Mama was slender and didn't look at all like going on 33. Her skin was as smoothly clear and her hair as black and curling as it had ever been. "Put her in a white dress," thought Francie, "with a bunch of roses in her arms, and she'd look like any 14-year-old graduate, except for the line between her eyes that cut deeper since Papa died." They ordered. Francie had a mental list of all the soda flavors. She was going down the list so that she could say she had tasted all the kinds of sodas in the world. Pineapple was next, and she ordered that. Neely ordered the old standby, chocolate soda, and Katie and Evie chose plain vanilla ice cream. Evie made up little stories about the people in the place and kept Francie and Neely laughing. Francie studied her mother from time to time. Mama wasn't smiling at Evie's jokes. She ate her ice cream slowly, and the line between her eyes deepened, and Francie knew that she was figuring something out. "My children," thought Katie, "have more education at 13 and 14 than I have at 32. And still, it isn't enough. When I think of how ignorant I was at their age... Yes, and even when I was married and had a baby. Imagine, I believed in witches' charms then, what the midwife told me about the woman in the fish market. They started in way ahead of me. They were never that ignorant. I got them graduated from grade school. I can't do more for them. All my plans, Neely a doctor, Francie in college, can't work them out now. The baby. Have they enough in them to get somewhere alone? I don't know. The Shakespeare, the Bible... They know how to play piano, but they've stopped practicing now. I taught them to be clean and truthful and not to take charity. Is that enough, though?" "They'll have a boss to please soon and new people to get along with. They'll get into other ways. Good? Bad? They won't sit home with me nights if they work all day. Neely will be off with his friends. And Francie? Reading. Away to the library. A show. A free lecture or band concert. Of course, I'll have the baby. The baby... She'll get a better start. When she graduates, the other two might see her through high school. I must do better for Laurie than I did for them. They never had enough to eat, never had right clothes. The best I could do wasn't enough. And now they have to go out to work, and they're still little children. Oh, if I could only get them into high school this fall. Please, God,
I'll give 20 years off my life. I'll work night and day. But I can't, of course. No one to stay with the baby.
Her thoughts were broken into by a wave of singing that rolled over the room. Someone started a popular anti-war song, and the rest took it up. I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I brought him up to be my pride and joy. Katie resumed her thoughts.
There's no one to help us. No one.
She thought briefly of Sergeant McShane. He had sent a big basket of fruit when Laurie was born. She knew he was retiring from the police force in September. He was going to run for assemblyman from Queens, his home borough, next election. Everyone said he'd be sure to get in. She had heard that his wife was very sick, might not live to see her husband elected.
He'll marry again, thought Katie.
Of course. Some woman who knows all about social life. Help him, the way a politician's wife must.
She stared at her work-worn hands for a long time, then put them under the table as though she were ashamed of them.
Francie noticed. She's thinking of Sergeant McShane, she guessed, remembering how Mama had put on her cotton gloves that time long ago, at the outing when McShane had looked at her.
He likes her, thought Francie. I wonder, does she know it?
She must. She seems to know everything.
Bet she could marry him if she wanted to.
But he needn't think I'd ever call him father. My father is dead, and no matter who Mama marries, he will only be Mr. So-and-so to me. They were finishing the song. There'd be no wars today if mothers all would say, I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier.
Nearly, thought Katie. 13. If war does come here, it will be over before he gets old enough to go, thank God.
Now Aunt Evie was singing softly to them, making up a parody on the song. Who dares to place a mustache on his shoulder?
Aunt Evie, you're terrible, said Francie as she and Neely screamed with laughter.
Katie jerked out of her thoughts and looked up and smiled. Then the waiter laid down the check, and they all grew silent, watching Katie.
I hope she's not fool enough to tip him, thought Evie. Does Mama know you're supposed to leave a nickel tip, thought Neely. I hope so.
Whatever Mama does, thought Francie, it will be the right thing. It wasn't the custom to tip in the ice cream saloons, except on special parties when you were supposed to leave a nickel. Katie saw that the check was for 30 cents. She had one coin in her old purse. It was a 50-cent piece which she laid on the check. The waiter took it away and brought back 4 nickels which he laid in a row. He hovered nearby, waiting for Katie to pick up 3 of them. She looked at the 4 nickels. 4 loaves of bread, she thought. 4 pair of eyes watched Katie's hand. Katie never hesitated once she put her hand on the money. With a sure gesture, she pushed the 4 nickels toward the waiter. "Keep the change," she said grandly. Francie had all she could do not to stand up on her chair and cheer. "Mama is somebody," she kept saying to herself. The waiter scooped up the nickels happily and rushed away.
"Two sodas shot," groaned Neely.
"Katie, Katie, how foolish," protested Evie. "I bet it's your last money, too."
"It is. But it may be our last graduation, too."
"McGarity pays us $4 tomorrow," said Francie, defending her mother. "And he fires us tomorrow, too," added Neely. "There'll be no money after that $4 until they get jobs then," concluded Evie. "I don't care," said Katie. "For once, I wanted us to feel like millionaires, and if 20 cents can make us feel rich, it's a cheap price to pay."
Evie recalled how Katie let Francie pour her coffee down the sink and said nothing more. There were many things she didn't understand about her sister. The parties were breaking up. Albie Seedmore, the leggy son of a prosperous grocer, came over to their table.
"Go to the movies with me tomorrow, Francie?"
he asked all in a breath.
"I'll pay,"
he added hastily. A movie house was letting the graduates attend the Saturday matinee, 2 for a nickel, providing they brought their diplomas along as proof. Francie looked at her mother. Mama nodded her consent.
"Sure, Albie,"
accepted Francie.
"See ya, 2, tomorrow.
He loped off.
"Your first date," said Evie. "Make a wish." She held out her little finger and crooked it. Francie hooked her little finger into Aunt Evie's.
"I wish I could always wear a white dress and carry red roses and that we could always throw money around like we did tonight," wished Francie.
Book 4. "You got the idea now," said the forelady to Francie.
You'll make a good stemma in time. She went away, and Francie was on her own, the first hour of the first day of her first job. Following the forelady's instructions, her left hand picked up a foot length of shiny wire. Simultaneously, her right hand picked up a narrow strip of dark green tissue paper. She touched the end of the strip to a damp sponge. Then, using the thumb and first two fingers of each hand as a rolling machine, she wound the paper on the wire. She placed the covered wire aside. It was now a stem. At intervals, Mark, the pimply-faced utility boy, distributed the stems to the petlers who wired paper rose petals to them. Another girl strung a calyx up under the rose and turned it over to the leafer who pried a unit, three dark, glossy leaves on a short stem from a block of leaves, wired the unit to the stem, and turned the rose over to the finisher, who wound a strip of heavier textured green paper around the calyx and down the stem. The stem, calyx, rose, and leaves were now one and seemed to have grown so. Francie's back hurt, and a shooting pain ran through her shoulder. She must have covered 1,000 stems, she figured. Surely it was time for lunch. She turned around to look at the clock and found that she had been working just 1 hour.
"Clock watcher," commented a girl derisively.
Francie looked up, startled, but said nothing. She got a rhythm to her work, and it seemed to come easier. One, she set aside the covered wire, and a half, she picked up a new wire and a strip of paper. Two, she moistened the paper. Three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. The wire was covered. Soon the rhythm became instinctive. She didn't have to count, and it wasn't necessary to concentrate. Her back relaxed, and her shoulder stopped aching. Her mind was freed, and she started to figure things out. This could be a whole life, she thought. You work 8 hours a day covering wires to earn money, to buy food, and to pay for a place to sleep, so that you can keep living to come back to cover more wires. Some people are born and kept living just to come to this. Of course, some of these girls will marry men who have the same kind of life. What will they gain? They'll gain someone to hold conversations within the few hours at night between work and sleep. But she knew the gain wouldn't last. She had seen too many working couples who, after the children came and the bills piled up, rarely communicated with each other except in bitter snarls. These people are caught, she thought. And why? Because, remembering her grandmother's repeated convictions, they haven't got enough education. Fright grew in Francie. Maybe it would be so that she'd never get to high school. Maybe she'd never have more education than she had at that moment. Maybe all her life she'd have to cover wires, one and a half, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. The same unreasoning terror came on her that had come when, as an 11-year-old child, she had seen the old man with the obscene feet in Loescher's bakery. In her panic, she speeded up her rhythm so that she'd have to concentrate on her work and not have room to think.
"New broom," observed a finisher cynically. "Trying to make a hit with the boss," was the opinion of a peddler.
Soon even the speeding up became automatic, and again Francie's mind was free. Covertly, she studied the girls at the long table. There were a dozen of them, Poles and Italians. The youngest looked 16, and the oldest 30, and all were swarthy. For some unaccountable reason, all wore black dresses, evidently not realizing how unbecoming black was to dark skins. Francie was the only one wearing a gingham wash dress, and she felt like a silly baby. The sharp-eyed workers noticed her quick stares and retaliated with their own peculiar brand of hazing. The girl at the head of the table started it.
"Somebody at this table has got a dirty face," she announced.
"Not me,"
answered the others one by one. When Francie's turn came, they stopped work and waited. Not knowing what to answer, Francie remained silent.
"New girl says nothing," summarized the ringleader. "So she's got the dirty face."
Francie's face got hot, but she worked faster, hoping they'd drop the whole thing.
"Somebody is got a dirty neck," it started all over again.
"Not me,"
answered the girls in order. When it came to Francie's turn, she too said, "Not me." But instead of appeasing them, it gave them more material to work on.
"New girl says her neck ain't dirty."
"She says."
"How does she know? Can she see her own neck? Would she admit it if it was dirty?"
"They want me to do something," puzzled Francie. "But what? Do they want me to get mad and curse at them? Do they want me to give up this job? Or do they want to see me cry the way that little girl did long ago when I watched her clean the blackboard erasers? Whatever they want,
I won't do it.
She bent her head over the wires and made her fingers fly faster. The tiresome game went on all morning. The only respites were when Mark, the utility boy, came in. Then they let up on Francie a little in order to work on him.
New girl, watch out for Mark,
they warned her. He was arrested twice for rape and once for white slavery. The accusations were crudely ironical, considering the obvious effeminacy of Mark. Francie saw how the unfortunate boy flushed a brick red at each taunt, and she felt sorry for him. The morning wore on. When it seemed that it would never end, a bell rang announcing lunchtime. The girls dropped their work, hauled out paper bags of lunch, ripped the bags open to form a tablecloth, spread out their onion-garnished sandwiches, and started to eat. Francie's hands were hot and sticky. She wanted to wash them before she ate, so she asked her neighbor where the washroom was.
"No speak English,"
answered the girl in exaggerated greenhorn dialect.
"Nicht verstand,"
said another who had been taunting her in idiomatic English all morning.
"What's a washroom?"
asked a fat girl.
"Where they make washers," replied a wit.
Mark was collecting boxes. He stood in the doorway, his arms laden, made his Adam's apple go up and down twice, and Francie heard him speak for the first time.
"Jesus Christ died on the cross for people like you," he announced passionately. "And now you won't show a new girl where the toilet is?"
Francie stared at him, astonished. Then she couldn't help it. It had sounded so funny. She burst out laughing. Mark gulped, turned, and disappeared down the hall. Everything changed then. A murmur ran round the table.
"She laughed." "Hey, the new girl laughed." "Laughed."
A young Italian girl linked her arm in Francie's and said,
"Come on, the new girl. I'll show you the toilet."
In the washroom, she turned on the water for Francie, punched down on the glass bowl of liquid soap, and hovered over Francie solicitously while she washed her hands. When Francie would have dried her hands on the snowy, obviously unused roller towel, her guide snatched her away.
"Don't use that towel, new girl."
"Why? It looks clean."
"It's dangerous. Some of the girls are working here is a clappy, and you'll catch it if you use the towel."
"What'll I do?" Francie waved her wet hands.
"Use your petticoat like we do."
Francie dried her hands on her petticoat, eyeing the deadly towel with horror. Back in the workroom, she found that they had flattened her paper bag and set out the two bologna sandwiches Mama had fixed for her. She saw that someone had placed a nice red tomato on her paper. The girls welcomed her back with smiles. The one who had led the taunts all morning took a long swig out of a whiskey bottle and then passed it to Francie.
"Take a drink, new girl," she ordered. "Them sandwiches is dry going down alone."
Francie shrank back and declined hastily.
"Go ahead. It's only cold tea."
Francie thought of the washroom towel and shook her head no emphatically.
"Ah," exclaimed the girl. "I know why you don't drink from my bottle. In the toilet, Anastasia scared you. Don't you believe her, new girl? The boss started that clappy talk himself so's we wouldn't use the towels. That way, he saves a couple of dollars each week on laundry."
"Yeah," said Anastasia. "I don't see none of yous using the towel."
"Hell, we only got half hour for lunch. Who wants to waste time washing hands? Drink up, new girl."
Francie took a long drink from the bottle. The cold tea was strong and refreshing. She thanked the girl and then tried to thank the donor of the tomato. Immediately, each girl in turn denied giving it.
"What are you talking about?"
"What tomato?"
"Don't see no tomato.
New girl brings a tomato for lunch and don't even remember."
So they teased her. But now there was something warmly companionable about the teasing. Francie enjoyed the lunch period and was glad she had found out what they wanted from her. They had just wanted her to laugh. Such a simple thing, and so hard to find out. The rest of the day passed pleasantly. The girls told her not to break her neck, that it was seasonable work, and they'd all be laid off when the fall orders had been made up. The quicker the orders were finished, the sooner they'd be fired. Francie, pleased at being taken to the confidence of these older, more experienced workers, obligingly slowed down. They told jokes all afternoon, and Francie laughed at them all, whether they were funny or just plain dirty. And her conscience bothered her only a little bit when she joined the others in tormenting Mark, the martyr, who didn't know that if he would laugh but once, his troubles in the shop would be over. It was a few minutes past noon on Saturday. Francie stood at the foot of the Flushing Avenue station of the Broadway L, waiting for Neely. She held an envelope containing $5, her first week's pay. Neely was bringing home $5, too. They had agreed to arrive home together and make a little ceremony out of giving the money to Mama. Neely worked as errand boy in a downtown